Welcome to On Human Non-Human Relations podcast number 43. Yes, indeed. So, welcome along to number 43 of this series, occasional series we call it nowadays, because I don't do it very often, obviously. So, my special guest then is Corey Wren, and Corey is a lecturer of sociology at the University of Kent in the UK. She received a PhD in sociology with Colorado State University in 2016, and she was awarded in the same year the Exemplary Diversity Scholar by the University of Michigan's National Center for Institutional Diversity, no less. Now, she's been published in several peer-reviewed academic journals, including the Journal of Gender Studies, Environmental Values, Feminist Media Studies, Disability and Society, Food, Culture and Society, and Society and Animals. In July 2013, she founded the Vegan Feminist Network. She is the author of A Rational Approach to Animal Rights, Extensions in Abolitionist Theory, which came out in 2016, and Piecemeal Protest, Animal Rights in the Age of Nonprofits, which came out last year in 2019. I'm really looking forward to this one. I hope you are too, so let's get on with it. Right, so Corey, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So we're really here to talk about your latest text, Piecemeal Protest, Animal Rights in the Age of Nonprofits. So congratulations on the publication of that. Now, also, I wanted to talk to you about sociology and a little bit about psychology, but that's a kind of follow-up. So as two sociologists, I think we could start by just indulging ourselves a little bit, because we do have a very sophisticated audience here. And your book has got a kind of very expansive kind of landscape of sociological knowledge. You know, you've got Weber, Bourdieu, Gramsci, C. Wright Mills, Goffman, and then quite a lot of social movement theorists in there. Some of which I recognise: McCarthy, Zald, McAdam, and Tarrow, in particular. So I just thought I'd initially invite you to give a broad overview of the book and invite you to kind of talk about how kind of sociology and sociological insights kind of feed into the themes that you developed.
Okay, there's a lot of angles I could take with this, but I think based on the audience, this book really started out of my activism. I was really in the trenches of animal rights activism. I'd started out doing on the ground stuff, but then as I moved into graduate school, it shifted to a lot of online stuff just because you spend more time in front of the computer. And one of the reviewers for this book, Matthew Cole, I have to give him credit for this. He really encouraged me to emphasize this bit a lot more in the final product. And that is, how can we use sociology to really speak to the activist community? Because animal rights activism has been mostly informed by philosophy and not so much by the social sciences, very little from sociology. And increasingly, there's some stuff from psychology. But I really did use this as a platform with Matthew's encouragement to think about what would I tell myself, and what if I were not a sociologist as an activist, what would I tell my friends as activists with the sociological knowledge? What can I teach them from this? So that's kind of the way the book is framed. It's thinking about not just an academic reader, but also the activist reader. And I'm hoping that my own activist background can make that bridge that a little bit and make it a little bit more approachable. So like I said, I started out as an activist. I didn't even really know that sociology touched on animal issues. And to be fair, animals and society as a subdiscipline really didn't come into its own until 10, 15 years ago. And this book started off as my PhD dissertation way back in 2008. So when I was thinking about what I wanted to do with this project, originally I was looking at kind of why veganism wasn't really taken seriously by the big nonprofits. But more than that, as I was actually doing the writing, I was really embroiled in a lot of the online kind of community and really the factionalism that was taking place. Because I'm sure a lot of listeners are aware, in the past few years, maybe it's kind of simmered down a little bit, but a few years ago, it really had popped off where there was a lot of debate about abolitionism. Really, at the time when I started this project, like Vegan Freak Radio had come out and they were big abolitionists. And there was a lot of discord in the movement. There was a lot of hurt feelings. A few years ago, it turned to kind of a feminist front line. So that's actually included in the book as well. And so basically using my own observations as an activist and saying, how can I interpret this sociologically? Because very little has been done from social movement in the social movement discipline about factionalism.
Yeah, we're going to get into the detail in a little while, but in relation to, I mean, it's interesting that you said that using sociology to inform activists, and Matthew Cole was the inspiration for that, because when I was doing my PhD, I did it alongside someone who was active in Earth First, and we kind of saw ourselves as bridge figures in the way that you've just explained, you know, in the sense that we thought we could translate the movement to academia and academia to the movement. But I've always been a little bit disappointed, really, picking up on
What way?
what you well, in the sense that psychology seems to be much more popular than sociology in the animal movement. Do you have any kind of theories about why that might be? I mean, I think we
I
do,
think, yeah.
but.
In fact, I do have a theory on that. I think I have an idea of what kind of psychology you're talking about, that which is pop psychology.
Sales psychology.
So what I have seen is that basically the book is not just about factionalism. It's also about what happens to a movement when capitalism sort of creeps into it and this nonprofit kind of model takes over. So really what happens is it really gets commodified. It's all about that bottom line. How can we make more money? How can we bring in more fundraising? And so one of the things, especially, I think Fawnalytics came out with a survey last year. But especially with the animal rights movement, people want to know where their money's going more than any other movement, at least according to this Fawnalytics study. And there's really not very much, because as I said, the social sciences have been really slow to kind of pay attention to the animal rights movement. So what happens then is the nonprofits, the charities themselves start to conduct their own research. And this is really interesting from a sociological point of view, again, because sociologists, we've been trained to think very critically about the production of knowledge. There's conflicts of interest and things like that. And there's not just research that we're looking at the animal rights movement, but across, like for instance, the British Sociological Association, their latest journal that came out as an article about the gay rights movement also has been producing really not really founded in good methodologies, and it's quite biased. So what I think is happening, why psychology is taking off, is because you have these kind of pop psychologists, folks who are not actually trained scientists in a lot of ways. I know Melody Joy is, but she was an adjunct professor. She wasn't even really full time. But you have a lot of folks who don't really have background in psychology who are leading these studies, conducting these studies, creating data. And lo and behold, the data supports what the organization already is doing. So then they can put on their end of year announcements. Look here, this is backed by science. And so it's just one more way to add credentials and legitimacy to an approach that, as we know, really has a lot of flaws. The focus on going veg or plate up for the planet or reform over abolition. So that is my theory. I think that actually has a lot to do with the nonprofit system.
That's interesting. I agree with that, of course. It's interesting. I think the pop psychology, the sales psychology stuff really came in with people like Nick Cooney, I think, in the movement. I was very interested. You said that people want to know where the money goes in the movement, which is interesting to me because I always kind of think that they don't take that much notice in the sense that there's a lot of duplication and waste in the movement, which people don't seem to notice, it seems to me.
But then again, Fawnalytics is conducting its own research. So once again, you have an issue of this is ultimately biased researchers. Not everyone in Fawnalytics is trained in this. Animal Charity Evaluators conducts a lot of its own research as well. And until recently, I remember when they first came out and started doing this, they didn't have anyone who was trained with this kind of stuff. So they're just, and I can also tell you a little insider information. I collaborate quite closely with a bunch of psychologists here at the University of Kent. They're also interested in efficacy and things like that. And they, like myself, are really frustrated with the fact that we don't have much social science out there on what works and what doesn't work. And so one of the things that they do kind of as a hobby is they will look at the data that's been produced by Faunalytics or Mercy for Animals, the Humane League and whatnot. And, you know, as trained psychologists, working psychologists, they say that this data and these methods are often just riddled with holes and often not very reliable. And oftentimes they just don't even know what they're doing with the data. They don't know what kind of data they have. So you have really a scramble to have evidence to support these tactics that really have, it's difficult to measure in the best of circumstances, but you have folks who really aren't trained to handle this type of inquiry.
I think you're right there, and that's the kind of point that Casey Taft makes as well quite often. Let's move on to a little bit of movement history, which is very interesting to me, at least, and I trust my listener is interested as well. You were in contact with Tom Regan in 2013. I had the pleasure of meeting him in Edinburgh in the 1990s, I think, and then a little bit later in Dublin, and he drew your attention to what he saw as very important historical events in the movement. I suppose the American movement, I suppose the North American movement, which was the National Institutes of Health, the sit-in, that's 1985, and the two Washington marches, 1990 and 1996. So could you say a little bit about all of that?
Right. So, full disclosure, I was born in 1983. So, all of this really happened before. Yeah. So, before, I mean, I asked him, I was like, you tell me you've been in this movement longer. And that's what he pointed to. And honestly, before I started this project, I didn't even know that there had been this big march. I mean, now we have marches all the time. But I'll start off with the sit-in. The sit-in in 1985, that was a moment in the movement's history before nonprofitization had really taken hold of the movement. Factionalism, of course, existed. And by the way, factionalism has existed in this movement since the beginning of this movement, way back in the 1820s. But that was a moment where the movement had not yet professionalized thoroughly, and there was a lot less factional discord. And he pointed to that as a time when people could get along and weren't doing so much backbiting, as he would say. It was a success. It was a single issue campaign where they wanted to stop the animal testing, so all the folks came in there and just kind of occupied the building. They tried to freeze them out with air conditioning. They tried to cook them out by turning the air off because it was a hot summer day. And ultimately, that campaign was a success. And so Tom Regan pointed to, look what happens when we can all come together. But of course, there's a lot of variables at play there. Like there was a single issue everyone was on top of. It wasn't a major victory. It was just one place. And of course, testing goes on elsewhere.
That issue, of course, was vivisection. So just to fill people in, it was basically on the back of the videos that came out of the laboratory, and we used to call it the Pennsylvanian primates, but it was kind of condensed down to a video called An Unnecessary Fuss, which is still on YouTube, and it was when the vivisectors were kind of filming themselves, and so it was never meant for public view. And I think still to this day, I think it's probably the most shocking kind of anti-vivisection film ever, I think.
Right. And I haven't seen it in years, and I don't plan to ever see it again.
No, it's
It's
pretty horrible now.
gruesome. But to his point, though, there were lots of folks from different kind of camps in the animal rights movement. They did come together and they accomplished this one short-term goal. But then I think what's more profound was the march, because the march really demonstrates what happens when factionalism and professionalization come into the picture. So by the 1990s, the animal rights movement was really moving towards professionalization. And by the way, this is something that happens for all movements. It's not just the animal rights movement. But what had happened was in 1990, they had organized this march. And again, it was back then, the single issue was vivisection. Animal agriculture really wasn't the big thing that it would later become. So it was a little bit easier to get everybody on the same page. It was much more radical. It was an animal rights march. There were lots of different estimates on how many people came. Tom Regan made it, I think, something like 70,000, 80,000, something really large. But I think more realistically, it's about 25,000 to 30,000 people.
You really downplayed it in the book, Corey. I was surprised by it, because I've seen those figures as well, 75,000. I think some of the organizers said 55, and then the lowest I think is about 25,000, isn't it? So.
The point is, it was still, regardless, a huge deal, a huge deal.
Oh
A
yeah.
lot of people turned up. So even if I'm giving the lowest possible estimate, it's still a lot of people. 1990, this is when the movement really had not been taken seriously yet. So all these folks turn up. It's super radical. And then because it was such a success, like, ooh, well, maybe we should do this again and try to organize it and be even bigger and stronger. But here's what happened. So that was organized for 1996. Well, 1996 just happened to be the, I mean, when I really looked back at all the data I had collected, all the analysis I'd done, it really looked like 1996 was a breaking point for the movement. That is where professionalization had really taken hold. All the major organizations had become corporatized. They watered down their message. I believe it was the Humane Society of the United States, which kind of took over the march, and they said, oh, we can't have rights language. Let's make it animal protection march or something like that. I can't remember the language anymore. But they watered down the message. They watered down the campaign. Tom Reagan even said, who was all against factionalism, even he said, on principle, I cannot be a part of this march. It
Yeah,
is
threatened
not
to
about animal
boycott it,
protection.
didn't
Yeah.
he?
And eventually he did go and speak, but he did boycott and it caused a lot of disruption. There was a lot of infighting going on over this. So ultimately, what ended up happening was that only about 3,000 people showed up and it was considered a dismal failure. And this is my favorite anecdote about it, but I was looking through some of the research. There was a social psychologist who had gone to the first march and conducted surveys and then went to the second march. But he was looking for attitudinal differences between the marches, but what he found was that the numbers had dropped so much. He says, ah, this is a wonderful case study in how a social movement
Yeah,
fails.
some guy with a name beginning with H, isn't it?
Maybe it was
Researcher.
Klaus, or maybe was it Herzog?
Yeah, I think it might have been, yeah. Anyway.
Well, we survived, and he's still on Twitter doing his animal thing too. So yeah, that was just an example of what had happened was the movement had professionalized and it started to enforce this kind of watered down messaging. And when that happens, I mean, they're calling people in line, but a lot of people are saying, you know what, that's not appropriate, and hence you have the factionalism. So he pointed to that moment as what happens when we don't work together. Look how we have failed. But I think that not so much a loss, but this is a very important turning point for the animal rights movement because this is where all the major factional divides are starting to reify. So this is when the no-kill movement is burgeoning. I think the very first no-kill conference was in 1996. So if not for that, we would still have, it would be totally acceptable for us to be gassing and killing otherwise dogs and cats who are healthy. I mean, that still happens, but we have a major criticism for that now. If it were not for factionalism, we might not be taking feminism and pro-intersectionality and racism issues seriously in the movement. So Feminists for Animal Rights in 1996 was really coming into its own. And then, of course, the abolitionist movement, Rain Without Thunder, published in that year, and that was a really scathing attack on professionalism. And also the ALF and other direct action organizations, they were really starting to become aggravated because their time in the sun was starting to kind of fade because it really was at odds with that kind of peaceful compromised approach that the nonprofits were using. So you had many cases that I found through my research where professionalized organizations would take material that had been gained from the ALF and other direct action organizations. They would use that material, but they would hide any association with them. So they're basically exploiting them. And of course, that really pissed them off.
Yeah, well, actually, funny enough, in Britain, it was a kind of accepted thing in a way because, you would hand over the documents, as it were, and they would claim that they found it on their step the next morning and stuff. And so there was this kind of tacit kind of agreement that the materials that we got from the labs we would hand over on the grounds. I mean, this is before the internet, we really, for people who are kind of relatively recent to the movement, the internet has changed everything. I mean, before then, you had to rely on the national groups because they had the clout, they could get the press and all that kind of stuff, and much, much more than we could in the ALF, So it was very, very kind of important in those days. So you mentioned
Yeah, absolutely.
1996, the big event, the publication of Francione's book, and of course he talks about the Washington marches there, and so does Reagan in the case, the revised edition. I don't suppose Tom told you about how he split with Francione. He didn't give you the inside story there, did he?
No, and actually, maybe this is a chance for you to jump in. From all I know is that he, I think, was just kind of what he does with everybody, just tries to claim their work and claim their kind of contributions. And what, tell me, what happened?
they both kind of had the same story, which is basically that, you know, as you said, 1990 was very kind of animal rights oriented. It was the time, certainly in the States, where the theory of Reagan was seen to be overtaking Singer. And then the story is that the kind of welfarists, if you like, or the nonprofits, as you put it, the national groups that I call them, they kind of reasserted their dominance of the movement. And so by the time we get to 1996, they toned everything down, which is kind of like the story of your book, really, which is, you know, they professionalize and then they moderate and then they tone down the message. And as you say, it went from animal rights to animal protection or something, animal aid, or, you know, all these things, mercy for animals. I hate that phrase. You know, all of that kind of thing. So that's the kind of story that Francione gives. But he also says that the thing that split him from Reagan was the fact that Reagan was going to boycott 96, and then he didn't in the end. And I think my own personal thing is that Reagan was a little bit too old. I think if he was 10 years younger and the internet would have come along when he was still relatively young, I think then both he and Francione would have probably seen that they could possibly really start a real animal rights movement. I think Reagan had kind of given up. You know, by the time we get to Empty Cages, it was a bit anecdotes and, you know, Gandhi and all that kind of stuff. So I think he kind of ran out of steam a little bit, unfortunately. And so Francione went and started his counter movement, but Reagan didn't go with him. And what's fascinating for me is what would have happened if they'd have stayed together and then the internet arrived. You know, that'd have been really
They wouldn't have. He can't stay with anyone more in a couple of years. And we both
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. Yeah. Well, we've both been through that mill, obviously. So I think you're right. This is a bit unkind, but I always say that there's going to be a revival of the abolitionist approach theoretical work once the man himself dies. Because
because
his personality is very toxic, but his ideas are pretty good. You know, so without the man, I think the ideas might come to the fore. You know what I mean? So that's my take. Anyway, let's move on from that little quagmire, I suppose. One sentence, and you've kind of covered this a little bit, but I still wanted to kind of talk about it. One sentence really stood out for me. You said factionalism is predictable and, I would argue, a healthy response to unhealthy compromise made with a capitalist state. So I don't know whether that should be made within a capitalist state or made with a capitalist state. Either way, they kind of say the same kind of thing. And really, this is your premise, isn't it? That people probably have got a downer on the idea of factionalism, whereas you actually think it's been quite useful.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I was saying, we wouldn't have so many advancements in this movement now if it were not for factional debate. And I want to be very clear, because those of you who are in the trenches right now and you're worn down from lost friendships over this, and it becomes very personal, but you just have to realize that all of these cries for unity and let's all come together, that's not realistic. First off, that's not how humans work in groups. But also, if we didn't have space for these disagreements, so Farm Animal Rights Movement, which runs the Animal Rights Conference every year in America, they have tried for years to silence this factional discourse. It's not possible, but also I don't think it's healthy. So I'd like to give one example is, for instance, with the Vegan Society. So here in the UK, well, the Vegan Society didn't just magically appear one day. Donald Watson didn't just kind of crawl out of a bush and say, let there be light. There had been decades of debate within the Vegetarian Society, and it can be traced along the Vegetarian Messenger and Journal, whatever it was called.
They
tussled with this for a long time, as you know, because you've done history on this as well. They wanted to have more unity, but ultimately they just said there was not space for these two convergent ideas, so they went off on their own. And of course, there's a risk with that. Factionalism is risky in that the radical group is going to be without that consistency, that legitimacy, those resources. But just think where we might be if those radical ideas were squashed, that factionalism was not allowed to kind of do what it needs to do. And I think more recent, the vegan thing, 1944, look how far we've come now, where veganism is now considered normal. The abolitionist movement also helped to push back on that plant-based veg reduce kind of crap and says, you know, we need to consistently promote veganism. And now it has become so much more normal. I mean, I've been away from the States for a couple of years, but here in the UK, I walk down the high street And you see vegan here, vegan there, vegan here, vegan everywhere, up and down the street. It's normal now. Look what we can do if we allow the factions to kind of do what they need to do. And then more recently with the feminist issue, where when I first started doing the feminist work, because it's kind of the same thing with Tom Reagan, Carol Adams is still active and online, but she's not doing what she used to have done. She kind of like is relegated to doing her academic writing and stuff. So we really needed people online in the trenches and this new wave of movement to be like pushing back on that. The resistance was extreme. It was the same old kind of stuff where you're being selfish. We need unity. Don't make this about yourself, blah, 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 blah. But now after a few years of this kind of back and forth, you're starting to see, it is normal now at conferences for feminist topics to be brought up. And it's normal now for nonprofits to consider not using a blanket approach to all communities. So factionalism is a healthy, healthy thing for a movement. Yes, there are costs to it. You're losing resources. It costs a lot, causes a lot of anguish. But without factionalism, really, that's like the breathing room this in the seams of our movement. We need to have more room to grow.
I'd agree with everything you just said there. You kind of preempted my next question, which is about FAR, really. Before that, funny enough, when I was writing my PhD, I had a long to and fro with Lee Hall, and she said, don't use the phrase UK, you know, say Britain. And so I said, why? And said, well, you know, it's not united and it's not a kingdom. So it's always been in my head since then. And I'm very reluctant to write UK. It's really kind of thing, you know, like, you know, when somebody says something and it just like sticks there and you think, oh, yeah, Britain. Anyway, so as you just mentioned, really, your feminist analysis is present throughout the text of the book. It's not surprising and it's very welcome. And in terms of a case study, you do talk about FAR, which is Feminists for Animal Rights. So can you speak about that issue for a while, please?
Oh, the feminist faction is a weird one. I think my general analysis is, and this, by the way, is a new project I'm going to be working on. My next book, I'm going to be looking at second wave vegan feminism. But I'm very interested in why the feminist faction is certainly a radical one, but in a lot of ways not radical. So they challenge a lot of power structures as far as like patriarchy, white supremacy, and colonialism, but they may not have this capitalist critique. And so this happened with FAR. So FAR, like most of the other big charities, started out as grassroots. It started out as chapter-based, primarily based in Berkeley, California, and Marty Keel is one of the co-founders. They struggled along. It was kind of like the Vegan Society. They struggled for a long time that this radical message, you know, about decentering maleness in the movement and bringing in all this really radical feminist stuff, because this is at the time in the late 70s and the early 80s where the feminist movement was really taking off, and they were implying that to animal rights. But you could always see that they had these aspirations for growth and this aspiration to actually become a nonprofit. And they struggled with this for years and years and years. And then around the turn of the 21st century in 2000 or so, they finally, after much struggle and fundraising, finally were able to become a charity. And they just weren't able to sustain after that. There's a lot of reasons that I had a little bit of an email chat with Carol Adams and some of the other folks who were involved with the founding of the group. It's been a while and I don't really remember what they said. And it was all quite elusive as well. It just really piqued my interest in why I want to write a book on just the vegan feminist element. But the issue here was that they didn't really have that critique of the capitalist nonprofit kind of consequences that happen when you take that route. But the ultimate thing was that they didn't survive. They struggled, tried to become a nonprofit, and it was not the kind of magic answer that they were hoping for. And this is the risk for a lot of these nonprofits or these smaller groups, is you really need to, one of the reasons why it switches to fundraising and compromise is that once you enter that nonprofit model, you no longer have the time to do that grassroots activism, the actual advocacy. Now most of your time is spent grant writing and fundraising and mobilizing those types of resources. And that's ultimately what happened with FAR. They didn't have enough support, and actually going the nonprofit way was one of the reasons that they ended up kind of going kaput. So it's kind of, it's just really, really funky one there, because, and you don't see any other, that was it. There was no other large group that took the feminist approach. And I'll be surprised if we don't have one that sprouts up one of these days.
Yeah, but I mean, it's an ongoing problem, isn't it? I mean, we a movement made up largely of women, but led mainly by white men, you know. So there's a problem, you know.
Well, now it's definitely being co-opted, because this is the other thing that I cover in the book, is that sometimes, or all the time, when these radicals actually start to have an impact, because they don't have any resources, they're working on a shoestring budget, sometimes just fully volunteer.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, right, yeah. So one thing you do have is a good argument and a rational argument, and you make sense and you can get to people. And when it's easy to do, because the nonprofits are not working truthfully. They spend a bunch of, you know, they spend their information in order to meet their bottom line. Whereas the radicals can be more truthful and say, this is actually what the animals need. This is what we need to do. And that can appeal to people. So what starts to happen is, say, with the abolitionists or with the feminists, and say, this is what we need to do. Here's the problems in the movement. And that starts to resonate. Then what you see is the nonprofits are like, ah, that's starting to resonate. So we need to tamper that down. We need to manipulate it so it works for us, and manipulate it so that it removes the threat of these radicals. And so now you're starting to see a lot of the major charities take on kind of watered down feminist stuff, like PETA. Shut up, PETA. PETA likes to call itself feminist now. It's like, don't even with that. If you go to like their online catalog, they'll have like feminist shirts and stuff. And I can't even with that.
Oh, yeah. I saw one recently. I couldn't believe it. Yeah.
Right. But I mean, on a less extreme scale, you'll have groups like Vegan Outreach, which will have some kind of like lip service to feminism and anti-racism. And they actually, to be fair, they do try to reach out to non-white communities and whatnot. So you're starting to see it does have an impact on the movement, but also it's going to be on their terms. So we want to maintain, like, be critical, keep our wits about us.
I think we might have covered this in a way, but I was going to, because like you've got a chapter about the first wave and the chapter about the second wave. So we don't really need to delve into that too much, I don't suppose. But I think you're suggesting, you can tell me if I've got this summary right, really, you're kind of suggesting that formalization, professionalization was a feature of the first wave. And then there was a kind of like grassroots radical bit, you know, maybe 1980s through to the 90s. And then we've got the, you know, the growth of the nonprofits again. As you say, they kind of steal the best bits from the grassroots and then moderate the message in order to sell it to a larger group. I mean, this is what happened to the Green Party in Germany. They had a kind of deep green agenda, and then you know, the main political parties came out with a light green version, but that was enough. And that's what happened in our movement all the time. But do you think that's a fair summary, what I just said there?
Yeah, I'd say so. The first wave of the animal rights movement began in Britain as the SPCA, and then it was struggling, because they're talking about the 1820s, and you know, people just didn't have that kind of cultural awareness yet. But then when Queen Victoria gave her patronage to it and turned it into the RSPCA, the Royal SPCA, it's essentially institutionalized it, then you see that it started getting all this money, all this prestige, all this legitimacy, and it started to grow. Today, I think I can safely say the RSPCA doesn't do jack shit. It's pretty much just like there. But that's kind of the way. There was a lot of grassroots mobilization. There's an excellent book that just came out, by the way, called Women's Advocacy in Victorian Britain. It just came out. It's up on my shelf. I can't see it, but there's a couple of books that actually delve into that. So there's a lot of grassroots work that women were doing. But what happened is they did set up in the 1800s several of these organizations, some of which still continue on today, and then just kind of like stuck there and didn't really do much. And then, of course, there was the world wars, and that kind of quelled a lot of activism, not just for animal rights, but in general. But then you started to see with the Oxford group and whatnot in the 1960s, all that kind of revitalized it. Then the social justice movement writ large, with the civil rights and all that, kind of reinvigorated. And you saw this wave of grassroots. And then that basically got co-opted by the nonprofit system. And I also want to point out that although I've been talking about these institutions that have been around since the 1800s, the nonprofit system, like nonprofits have been, or you know, professional charities have been around, but it really was not until we entered that age of austerity in the late 80s and the 90s that we start to see these pop up. And the reason why is that they take care of social services very affordably. It relieves the state of that responsibility, but the state also benefits because you have all these activists who are now basically transparent to the state. They work with the state instead of against the state. So it kind of is a win-win, unless you're the constituency, in this case, non-human animals, where it really is questionable as to what they do gain when you have animal rights, quote unquote, rights organizations working with the state. And then you start to see these outcomes of, well, the cage is slightly bigger, pat them on the head before we slit their throats or stuff like that. So we want to be very careful then about the nonprofit system itself. I think that's a relatively new phenomenon, although we've had these institutions hanging around for a while. I don't think that a lot of activists actually have this kind of knowledge, this working knowledge of what nonprofits mean, what the compromises are that are inherent to them, and what's their history? They haven't been around forever. Why are they now becoming the norm for activism? And why is it that so many activists move that way unthinkingly and just think that growing is just like with feminists for animal rights? They didn't really have a critique. Like, what does it mean that we're going to get bigger and bigger and bigger? And where is the off switch for this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's interesting because my MA dissertation was about the British movement. I ended up calling it a sociology of compromise for the very reasons that you've just said. Actually, I got an interesting anecdote, very short, about the RSPCA. When the BYV was being radicalized, they organized a lot of people to join and then go to the AGM of the RSPCA in order to vote out as patron the Queen of the RSPCA. And so that vote came up in the morning, and she was duly voted out. And then we came back after lunch to be told that the council had restated her as the patron of the RSPCA. So that didn't last too long, a little bit of rebellion.
So now that whole structure is gone, right? You can't vote. I think the Vegan Society is like the only organization that lets you vote anymore, right?
Yeah, I think they've all kind of changed. Democracy is a threat to power bases. And
right. I think activists need to be aware of that as well. So especially for someone my age, where I grew up in an animal rights kind of community where we never expected to have democratic access at all. And so to learn that history, I think it's very important to know that it was only until recently that we as activists and donors or whatever it may be, volunteers, had access to, and we made decisions communally about what this organization could and should do. Where now it's like the Vegan Society is the only holdout. And now I think it's very interesting in the third wave of activism is what I call now this era of professionalization. What also characterizes it is the internet. And so that's a way that we're kind of bringing our voice back in and putting pressure back on. And these leaders of these big organizations, they are seeing it. They can't avoid this kind of internet presence in a lot of ways.
The power elite don't like democracy, really, do they? So
no, there's a reason why they kept shutting. They shut down chapters and they shut down the voting across the board.
Yeah. Now, I've got a couple of questions from Kevin Watkinson. This first one is, has effective altruism replicated and intensified issues of movement factionalization or factionalism?
Oh,
big question. That's Kevin for you.
Well, I don't think it has as much as it should. I feel every time that I critique that, I'm kind of all my own with it. Because again, I don't think that's one of my goals with this book was to really get people thinking more critically about what it means to be an activist in a capitalist system. And I don't think a lot of people think critically about what it means to rationalize our activism in that way, where it's down to efficiency and effectiveness. And then, by the way, who's defining what effective means? And you have animal charity evaluators who say, how much money do you raise? And that really has nothing to do with how we liberate animals necessarily. So in that way, I don't know. I mean, I'm a little bit out of touch now with the online community, online activism and the debates because, actually it's worth saying because this factionalism, as you know, as well, it becomes so draining and emotionally like tiring that I had to step back. And here I am, the author of a book on this kind of stuff. So maybe I don't know what's going on anymore, but I will say that when I talk about when I criticize the Peter Singer effective altruism stuff, I feel like I'm on my own and nobody knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, there's some bits about Singer in the book that I didn't know about him founding those things in Australia and how he squashed down the radicals. I didn't know all that. It's really interesting. Okay, so moving on to Kevin's second question, which is about critical animal studies, and he's asking about how have they responded to the presence of billion-dollar foundations which are moving into animal advocacy. No, they're taking, what's their response to all that?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I could say that having moved now to Europe, I'm not allowed to say I'm in Europe after Brexit, I don't know, that when I participate in conferences here and liaise with folks, I feel like they have a pretty good understanding of or a good critique. The folks I work with at the University of Kent, however, are all they're all about this kind of effective altruism stuff. So I don't know. I think that there's room to improve. I think we need to start being a little bit more critical. I think that in Europe, there's a little bit more of a general understanding, whereas maybe with American critical animal studies folks, not so much. But then again, David Nybert's collection that we were both in that came out, what, 2, 3 years ago? And that brought together a lot of animal studies folks who kind of got that this is, we need to have a critique of these big charities. But honestly, when I go to like write and research on this, I don't have a big volume of publications from critical animal studies folks to really source or to reference. So I really, really hope that this is something that we start to take more seriously because we need that capitalist critique.
Well, we need a lot more critical thinking in the movement, full stop, really, I suppose, in that sense. I really enjoyed your appearance on Always for Animal Rights, and I heard there that you're a big fan of Go Vegan World, which is based here in Ireland. And if Jordan Wyatt is listening, Ireland is not in Britain or the UK or anything like that. He sent me a package where he put Ireland, UK, Britain, and this kind of stuff, just to wind up. Just to wind up the
Watch
possums.
out.
I know, yeah. So you're a big fan of Go Vegan World, but in the book you give an account of the reaction, from the national groups to the Be Fair, Be Vegan billboards, and you said that it received a lot of grassroots praise, but there's a bit of silence really from the national groups. That's right, isn't it?
The whole thing is kind of weird because I remember when it came out, I was like, whoa, this is a big deal. We should be talking about it. And no one really did, except for people and really the abolitionist spaces and elsewhere. And then nothing really came of it. As far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Sandra Higgins had told me once that she really didn't think it was the best use of money to be putting it in Times Square because of all the information overload. Whereas I have been to Ireland several times when her campaigns, well, they're still running, but you see them everywhere and you turn on the radio and people on the radio are talking about it and you look at the newspaper and it's in the newspaper. It's having a huge impact in Ireland.
That's
So
right,
maybe a
yeah.
little bit more bang for the buck there. But
Yeah,
the
it
whole
was Go
thing,
Vegan Ireland at first, of course, and then it went into Go Vegan World. So,
And I really haven't seen, when I go to Ireland, I see your stuff all the time, but I haven't really seen anything over here in Canterbury yet, and nor have I seen it in London. Although I know she does London sometimes.
think it was in the tube system recently. I think she tried to get into the tube system a couple of years ago, and I think she couldn't quite get the money together, and so Peter stepped in. And I think they changed it from go vegan to go veg on the posters.
Shut
So who would have guessed? I mean, we're moving towards the end really, but I wanted to talk about another form of silencing or silence really, which features in the book, because you talk about the national nonprofits generally staying fairly aloof from engagement with the critiques that come from the grassroots of the movement. But they don't always stay silent, and sometimes they answer back, as it were. But they often do that by reframing things. For example, claiming that abolitionists, to use that phrase, for example, may be divisive, not living in the real world, being unrealistic, a purist, not of sound mind, or more bluntly than that, they're just plain crazy, along with other kind of ableist slurs, which, in the book, a lot of those kind of seem to come from the pen of Matt Ball. You've got a lot of ball in your book, actually. And you also say that Melanie Joy says that the radicals, in terms of their radicalism, may be committing strategic suicide. So that seems to be an issue that we've both kind of witnessed. And I don't see it as much now, because I think they've been proved wrong. I mean, they were the ones who were saying that veganism was a scare word only 4 years ago. Don't go near veganism, Tobias Leonhardt and all that kind of stuff. Don't mention animal rights, don't mention veganism and this kind of stuff. And now I think they've been proven, as you say, you go around just everywhere and you see signs. It's all over the cafes, big vegan signs. So the idea that veganism is a scare word, they've been proven completely wrong, but I doubt if they'll ever admit it, though.
Yeah. Well, it's a shame because this summer, and it's now because of the coronavirus, it's been called off, but we had a conference, an animal rights conference that was going to be here at my university, and he and Melanie Joy were going to be speaking as keynote speakers. And my colleague Christopher Daunt, who's the psychologist who put it on, he was going to put me on stage and let me at him. I guess just for some entertainment value, because he knows where I stand on all that. So it would have been interesting to see if they do stand by those positions.
Well, funny enough, I spoke to somebody in Ireland who went to one of their what do they call it? Their workshops, you know,
Training. Oh, the training. Oh,
training,
that's another thing. That is another thing that I mentioned in the book that I find very subversive, that they will go out and give free training to college students and grassroots groups. And
No,
like, they're doing
you got to
socializing.
pay for these ones though.
Oh, okay. Oh, well,
Yeah,
go
you got
on
to
then.
pay for. But this guy was saying that there was a lot more mention of veganism now than
Okay.
say before. And of course, I think it's a little bit recipient design in a way, you know, borrowed from ethno, because I think when they've got a vegan audience, they do ramp up the vegan, and then you know they then go back to you know, going back to the, oh, vegans are a little bit purist and crazy and everything, when they've got a different kind of audience. So I think they try and kind of, you know, tweak it, if you like, for different audiences. But you never know. I mean, maybe we've moved them on in the same sense as I was talking to somebody today about one of the national groups in Britain, and it was only about 3 or 4 years ago that they had the veggie starter kit. And of course, now all their claims making is based on veganism. But I don't think the grassroots will ever get the credit they deserve, because we were the ones who pushed them to do that. They were the
Yeah.
ones. They were the ones saying, "No, say veggie, say veg," and all this kind of stuff. And we were going, "No, we're vegans. We're going to say vegan." You know, Donald Watson, ripen up. You know, and all this kind of stuff. And no. That's suicide, as Melanie Joy says. But we've proven it to be wrong. So you know,
That's
that's.
all right. I don't need a cookie for being right.
Okay. And finally, you actually you got a chapter. We've covered it really. You got a chapter, and it's called "Abolition to Compassion," which kind of I think people can gather from the title what that's all about. But you say interestingly that DxE might be the latest group to go that way, yeah?
At last I checked, they're pretty much there. But it's interesting because when I first started the project, they were brand new. And I guess like a similar situation would be here with Surge, which I just found out about. I've been so out of touch with the new stuff. But it started out very grassroots, young people going out and kind of just raising hell. And then as they started to get popular and get attention, then they started kind of the leaders of that organization started working with the leaders from like PETA and whatnot. And I remember Nathan Winograd went along all the different chapters and sent a post, put a post on their Facebook page. Said, "How can you collaborate with PETA? They kill animals. What are you doing?" And so that was, I think, the big red flag for me. Like, uh-oh, watch them. And then you started to see gradually, instead of come out and support us, it was, can you donate to us? And now they start to send, just like all the other organizations, I've signed up to their newsletter and I just get these emails every once in a while asking for money. And you can
Yeah,
support our
it's all about
activism.
donations, donations, donations.
Yeah.
I was flabbergasted because they claimed they need $10,000 to rescue a mammal and $2,000 to rescue a bird. And like, you know, we're kind of doing that in the sanctuaries in Ireland all the time. You know, but you don't have to raise that money in advance. I mean, it was basically kind of you know, kind of emotional blackmail. You know, they're kind of going, if we don't raise this, then we can't rescue them, you know, that kind of stuff.
All right, this is totally exploiting and pimping non-human victims.
Yeah, absolutely. Every now and again, you get a big load of fundraisers coming through from DxE. You know, it's kind of one of the main things they do now. You know, there's not a lot of evidence about, you know, where did it go? I know that some of the sanctuaries have complained that they haven't got it, even though they might have been caring for some of the other animals were rescued.
Geez,
Or...
I'm out of the loop. I haven't heard any of this.
So yeah, that's a little bit of dirt to end with, I suppose. Anyway, listen, Corey, it's been great to talk to you at last. I mean, we've obviously known each other for a while in terms of our work, and we've kind of, you know, cross-fertilized in many ways, I suppose. Now, I usually end up, I give you some warning at the beginning of this. So I usually end up with a song. I usually give my guests the choice of whether they want to choose it or not. So would you like a bit of music at the end?
All right. What is that song where it's like, nobody's gonna hold me down? Oh no, I've got to keep on moving.
I don't know.
The
Instead
one
of
from the 80s,
song,
the 80s
you
version.
could just sing it if you like, instead of having the song.
So the big nonprofits can smoke that and put that in their pipe and smoke
Yeah. I don't know that song. If it's not from the 1970s, I don't know it.
Well, shoot.
That's yeah, I'm a bit stuck in the 70s, to be honest.
I'll find it.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what then. You send it to me and I'll stick it on the end of this.
All right.
Okay. So thanks
Thanks,
very
Roger.
much, Corey, for being my guest. I hope you've enjoyed the experience. I've certainly learnt a lot, and I recommend the book. Of course, these academic books now—they're so expensive, aren't they?
I fully am opposed to this mess, and anyone who emails me, we can come to an agreement. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I interviewed Ronnie, Ronnie Lee, and he was very upset about the cost of his book. And Steve Best's book, I mean, it's kind of like a fortune, The collection that we were both in with David Nybert, that was a fortune as well,
Yeah. So, I mean, my first book finally went to paperback after 3 years, and even then it's like 25 quid. But like there's for people who don't know, pretty much all academic research for academics like myself who don't give a shit, you can go to researchgate.net or academia.edu and you can actually engage with researchers one-on-one and sometimes access their research. It's
Right, very
kind of
good.
a bit of a loophole, legal loophole. But a lot of people have been emailing me through those two websites to chat about my book, so I would recommend that. And also for anyone who isn't prepared to read a whole book, you can go to my website at coreyleewren.com, and every journal article I've ever published is up to read there. Every blog essay, all my radio interviews, anything like that, if you want to learn more.
Excellent. Yeah, that's good. And remind me of the title of the one that's gone to paperback.
As a rational approach to animal rights.
That's the one. Yeah. Okay. So that's good. So that's fairly kind of affordable now. And I heard a rumor that people are reading now during the shutdown and everything, which is was quite good. Funny thing is that the most witty thing that Francione ever said, I think, was that people
People don't
get
read
fatigued.
anymore.
No, he said people get fatigued after reading a tweet. And so he was
Right.
trying to explain why people don't read books anymore, which obviously.
Yeah, I did think that was good that he like pushed like average activists, like you do actually have to go out and read, you have to actually pick up a book.
Well, again, going back to ideas, which, I mean, a lot of them were borrowed, stolen, whatever, adapted from Reagan, of course. But in terms of ideas, we do have the fact that veganism is the moral baseline now, even though that's a controversial claim. Francione played a big role in that, starting with Rain Without Thunder. So, right, so we're through. So thank you very much, Corey, and I'll say good night. And thanks for everybody for listening, and I'll catch you next time. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
And so we come to the spot where I say that as a kid, I wanted to be a DJ, but I didn't have the brains to get together like John Peel, go over to the States, put on a Liverpool accent, and become famous. Spot. So Corrie seemed to have found the song that she was searching for, and it was a number 5 in the US and A, and it was a number 4 in the UK, and it's called Break My Stride from 1983, and it's by Matthew Wilder.
Break my stride. Nobody gonna slow. another girl like you.